The following podcast is intended for mature audiences. Listener discretion is advised. So, kids shouldn't be listening. Elton says fuck and shit a lot, sometimes fucking shit, but rarely does he advocate actually fucking shit. You get it? Enjoy the show.
Prepare to embark on a journey of the mind. All right, that's a little much. I'm not that good. I know. Prepare to be transported. How about that? Prepare to be transported via your own brain. Brain sporting, if you will, through the corridors of time, where the shadows of Victorian England come alive. And by shadows, of course, I mean those awful times with grimy soot-covered everything, opium dens and shit, literal shit and piss, homeless kids in debtors' prisons, and the homeless kids in debtors' prisons. Oh, and the echoes of a literary titan's origin story, and the stories he made using it. That reverberate through the ages. Was that poorly worded? Perhaps. And yes, it was. I'm sorry. In this episode, we'll explore the life of the late, great, and as we'll discover, not so great, Charles Dickens in his book, Great Expectations, and find out if it lives up to, you know, the great expectations of people that expect things about, I don't know what I'm saying. We'll delve into the fascinating genius behind the classic Victorian tale and learn why he wrote what he wrote, more or less. Why? Because how often do you run into a guy with a suffix? With a suffix named after him. The suffix being Dickensian. Sure, it's not a great one, as it means squalid and poverty-stricken, but I mean, I don't have one. Do you have one? I don't care. I don't care, I'm jealous. Oh, and we'll find out why he wanted to send his wife to an insane asylum. Why can't I say words today? And why? And we'll find out why he hated America so damn much. He for real hated it for a while. Yeah, keep listening to find out why.
Countdown for blast off. X-5, 4, 3, 2... X-1, fire.
Welcome, 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 welcome to the other side of the theme song. I am your host for this podcast about books that is also about books. I got nothing. It's been a hell of a week, and I've had no sleep. My name is Elton, and I read a book a week. That was some rhyming kind of shit going on there. The book this time around, like I said earlier, is the classic Great Expectations by Charles Dickens, a book that is pretty great for expectations. Did that make sense? No, of course not. What were you expecting? Greatness? All right, I'll stop. I promise I won't keep doing that. A lot. Before being told to read this book in junior high, I had only heard about it in the way one hears about Shakespeare or Einstein. I knew people smarter than me knew about it and read it, and that was about it. I was pretty sure it was probably about a snotty entitled kid that, you know, went for a long time getting everything he wanted until one day he was told he would have to fulfill some kind of criteria to get whatever he actually wanted. And it fucking pissed him off. Until he uttered the phrase in kind of a frustrated assholery. Oh, great. Expectations. So, you can imagine my surprise when I actually read the damn thing and discovered it's about a dirt poor kid in dirt poor Victorian England doing his dirt poor best not to be dirt poor. Victorian England, by the way, is by most measures, the worst England. I'm pretty sure if all of history had a vote, Victorian England would be voted the worst England ever, coming in a very close second to medieval England, which had only slightly worse poverty, mortality, and dental hygiene. Oh, shit, England, old and new, I'm throwing that unwanted orthodontic periodontal shade, okay? I hope you didn't put on sunscreen for your pasty, pale, whiter-than-white skin, because you won't need it under all this General Dentistry Shade. Didn't expect that, did you? No, me throwing some really hack pedestrian English teeth jokes. Throwing them at you, huh? You didn't see that bad teeth. Bad teeth. That's right. You have really bad...
Well, that's one way to kill an audience.
Please. They have better health care than I do. Some better working conditions, too, as I understand it. Oh, and cool accents. Even the hard-to-understand ones are cool. Plus, I want to move there. For real. Legit. I'm sure hacky jabs at their teeth are the least of their problems.
You're probably wrong, but that's never stopped you before.
I appreciate your candor, Speaking of candor and awkward segues, how's the talks with the guy that knows about, that knows more than we do about how to send Shep back to the other side? How's that coming along?
Oh, I'm dying to hear this. No pun intended.
Oh, hi, Mr. Shepard. I'm sorry to hear that Elton got you stuck in between this mortal plane of existence and the great beyond. My only consolation for you is to say that Elton isn't good at so much more than that.
Oh, come on. Well, okay. You didn't answer the question, did you? Any word on how to send Shep, back to the nether realm or whatever?
Well, being that all of that is a definite you problem and not a me problem, I'm thinking that the onus for that whole thing is lying firmly on your side of the figurative fence. Know what I'm saying? Gee. Weird, why did I go all gangsta there at the end?
What? You didn't talk to the guy?
God, no. That guy was super scary. Weird. First, weird English accent. Two, he seemed completely disinterested and downright bored with the whole thing. That left me thinking, if raising the dead bores you, what kind of insanely scary crap gets him excited? I do not want to know. Oh, and third, he drives a 1989 Mazda Miata. Who does that? Oh, let's not forget that on top of all that, I said that was this was a one-time thing. I was pretty clear on the subject, so no, I'm not dipping my toes in that puddle of dead raising weirdness. Once was enough.
Oh, damn it, we need to do something.
I've threatened to poltergeist him.
Oh, like the movie show or cartoon?
Focus.
A poltergeist cartoon?
Yeah, Casper. He was a poltergeist, right? Or am I remembering that wrong?
Oh, what the fuck?
Hey, don't get all huffy with her. She's just being helpful.
Yeah, Elton, I'm helpful. He gets it. I'm being a freaking delight over here. And Shep. Listen, if you're going to get into this whole Casper vibe, just know that Elton here has books all over the place, large and small. I've heard they make for great projectiles in a pinch. It'll keep him on his toes.
Hey, thanks for the tip.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
You know, I'm sorry that you're probably going to be an unlucky participant in random games of Dodgebook with Shep. I really am, but, the phenomena of poltergeist has always been very fascinating to me. So to be part of it, even by proxy, is a truly one-of-a-kind experience. And to freaking instigate it and have it be real, that is some truly rarefied air, sucka. Know what I'm saying? I'm not going to pass that up. Besides, maybe a little haunting will do you good. Get that tired blood a-pumping. If it were me, I'd be getting real familiar with catechism, sacramentals, and voodoo super duper fast. Get to nipping your future book-related head injuries in the bud and send Shep here back to the clouds.
I'm so glad that getting beaten up by Shep's flying books can help quell your poltergeist fascination.
You're very kind. Thank you for your dedication to my cause.
No problem, Gene, my man. I just want what's best. On that note, look, I would fist bump you, give you that gesture of camaraderie, but hey, no offense, you freak me the heck out. I apologize.
No apologies needed, ma'am. I fully understand and would probably feel the same were the situation reversed.
For fuck's sake.
Hey, wordy dirds are only going to drag this out come prayer time. Man up, get on Amazon and get something like a Tobin spirit guide, maybe something from the occult arts and esoteric sciences section or whatever, and get to work. This undead fella isn't going to re-dead himself.
Damn it.
Hey, and I appreciate that. Really, I do. Just remember, Elton, old boy, duck and cover, okay? Duck and cover.
All right, I'm moving on. Oh, and British folks, I was kidding. I probably don't even have to mention it. You invented better humor, so So recently I revisited Great Expectations with my years of accumulated wisdom, you know, deepened reserve of knowledge and keen insight gained from years of hardscrabble life experience under my belt. Needless to say, I still laughed at that cover because the first thing I thought was, aw, fucking Great Expectations. It just goes to show that even as I get older, there's still a little part of me stuck in junior high. I'm not sure if that's good or bad, or even if it applies to anyone, everyone. But it definitely applies to me. As for my adulted interpretation of the book, well, my broken brain tended to focus on the wrong things. Shit, I don't even remember. My childness, younger brain really locking onto. I mean, Mrs. Havisham, the old lady in the story, she's an absolute asshole. Estella is raised to be an asshole, and lo and behold, she turns out to be a total asshole. Yet, Pip, the protagonist, still wants to get with her. What the fuck? Oh, and Herbert Pocket? What the fuck with the random fight? The kid picks a fight for no fucking reason. Anyway, sorry. I just randomly, you know, shouting. Sorry, I'm just randomly shouting bits of the story into the ether. But for me, it begged the question, what's the deal with the weird motherfucker that wrote this story about all these assholes? Well, what's his deal? What the shit is Charles Dickens' fucking deal? What the fuck, Chuckles Dickens? Okay, I'm done. Charles Dickens was born Charles John Huffman Dickens on February 7th, 1812, in Portsmouth, on the southern coast of England. The city has been one of the main homes of the British Royal Navy since 1194, Jesus Christ, and continues to be an important seaport. Portsmouth is technically the only island city in Britain. Charles was the second of 8 children, so of course that means, you know, he had to grapple with his siblings for his father's love. A man who subjected them to brutal cage matches against each other, eventually involving people outside of the family because you can only beat up your siblings so many times. Charles Dickens' fearlessness and ferocious fighting style earned him high praise in the mean streets of London. A few of the local matches were praised as being innovative and savage, leading him to become a local celebrity of sorts, known for trouncing up-and-coming fighters in one round or less. One-and-done Dickens took all comers, culminating in a bout that's still talked about by historians today. Her reputation preceded her, as did her ruthless style and lightning speed at which she dispatched other fighters. Boxing legend Sylvia Ball Basher Plath took on Charles Dickens in a bare-knuckle match on a barge, and as legend would have it, after exhausting the pool of fighters in her own time, she time-traveled to battle every bare-knuckle champion through the ages so that she could be crowned the greatest bare-knuckle boxer of literally all time. Nothing? Nothing? You guys aren't jumping in and interrupting that? I thought somebody, you know, thought somebody would have something to say about that.
Nope. I'm still over here, trying to rest in peace.
Sometimes you have to just avert your eyes and let the train keep wrecking, or the engineer will never learn how to drive it, you know?
I've never heard that expression. That's horrendous.
No? How about sometimes the best lessons in life are blindingly, irrevocably painful? Know that one.
Holy shit, no. No. Wow.
Maybe keep the mocking to a minimum there, Elton. I'm pretty sure that's from the Bible. Show a little respect.
Well, wow. No. No, I'm sure it isn't, but I'm moving on now.
Oh, you do that. And in the meantime, I'm going to find that chapter and verse just to prove you wrong. Come to think of it, I'm pretty sure it was Jesus that said it. Elton.
Okay. Moving on. So Dickens was born in Portsmouth, a city located in Hampshire, England. That's about 70 miles southwest of London, growing up in what is now considered a large family, but back then was just a regular-sized family trying to cheat death. I'm sure Charles didn't have to earn his parents' love via fisticuffs. I'm sure his presence was tolerated as much as any English kid born in the Georgian era, who also happened to just slip into the sub-era called the Regency era. A time when, which I believe we touched on in an earlier episode, or at least about books written and set in that particular era. So many eras, England, already. Stop making so many. You have eras happening inside of eras already. Fucking era inception going on over there. That's a Christopher Nolan movie. That's a Christopher Nolan movie I'd watch. Still, chill the fuck out, England. Charles Dickens' father, John Dickens, was a naval clerk who dreamed of striking it rich and would kill anyone who stood in his way. A straight-up pusher, he would slang that china white to fiends on the corner. For Charles's mother, Elizabeth Barrow, a lovely woman who aspired to be a teacher and a school director, and would also kill anyone who stood in her way, a straight-up pusher who would also slang that china white to different fiends on a different corner. It was a match made in murder. Drug dealing murder. Okay, sorry. Too many movies growing up. They were just a normal non-heroin dealing, non-greedy to homicidal ends kind of people, you know. Well, so far as the sources say. Side note, China White is an old derogatory and racist slang term that was implemented to assuage users from indulging in heroin, you know, by associating it with those dirty, grubby, stupid, drug-pushing Chinese people. Because that's how drug users, and illogical stereotypes work. Just add a little racism and everybody will kick their habit and no more drug problem. Racism. The quicker, hate-fueled answer to rehabilitation since at least the 1800s. Fucking hell, people are stupid. The nickname, China White, rather than discouraging people from using heroin, was instead reclaimed by the drug culture as a slang term for it later. It's still around today, but has been repurposed yet again for a new synthetic variation of heroin that's cut with fentanyl. It's called 3-methylfentanyl and is considered to be one of the most potent opioids. Sooner or later, everything old is new again. Stephen King from The Colorado Kid. I'm pretty sure he didn't mean racist dipshit blaming Chinese people for heroin's addictive properties, but generally speaking, it still works. Charlie's dad was an addict, though, but of a different, somewhat equally destructive sort. He was addicted to losing the fuck out of his own money and his family's money. He was absolute shit with it. Charles Dickens had a tumultuous childhood, marked by financial problems, largely caused by his father, that would lead the family to move several times in his childhood. The first time was to Chatham, when Charles was just a child. It was a slightly smaller house, at 18 St. Mary's Place, but it was what the Dickenses could afford. After Daddy John Dickens fucked up the family cash flow, still, these Chatham years were hugely important for the development of Dickens's imagination. His vivid, astonishingly detailed... His vivid, astonishingly... There it is. Detailed memories of everything he experienced there would find their way into his writing later. His love of reading would help, too. A voracious reader when he was little. Mary Weller, a teenage nursemaid who was one of two live-in servants employed by the family, later reminisced of Dickens as a child. He was, as she recalled, a terrible boy to read, meaning that's all that little bastard did, read. Was he into bare-knuckle boxing like the rest of his friends? No. Did he dip into the China White and hop on the H train to Skagville Heights? No. He was just a punk-reading bitch who complained about my wanting to push him into fighting and drug use all day. Go out and bloody them fists while on drugs, Charlie. Useless child. No. No. You get it. Reading richly fed his later fiction and inspired some of his finest journalistic essays. Being a very little kid and a very sickly boy who was subject to attacks of violent spasm, holy shit, he was debarred. All night long. That's not, I think that's Lionel Richie. What am I doing? He was debarred from sporting activities. So I'm thinking of DeBarge, the singer from the 80s. Who did the "Who's Johnny?" She said that song. That song he definitely fucking did. Charles Dickens was debarred from sporting activities. So no knuckling up time-traveling Sylvia. She would have fucking taken his sickly ass easily. Regardless. He enjoyed games of make-believe with his friends and getting up. It actually, the source actually said getting up magic lantern shows. Which is like a lantern with one side that has a lens on it that they would put pictures in. And it would show on a, you know, a sheet or a wall or something. Like a, I don't know. You know, the fucking thing you put on your eyes and you get it. Projector. Fucking whatever. Also, he would perform duets with Fanny, his oldest sibling and sister. They'd perform comic songs and recitations with, according to Mary Weller, again, such action and such attitudes. Well, well. Daddy Dickens was proud of his children's singing talents, which were sometimes publicly exhibited at the Mitre Tavern in Rochester. This old city, which adjoins Chatham with its ruined castle, ancient cathedral, and picturesque high street, fascinated the young Charles and was indeed the birthplace of his fancy. So, how's about that shit? Also, it was the little Rochester Playhouse that gave him his earliest thrilling experiences of what became one of the master passions of his life, the theater. In the years the children were growing up, live theater could be seen all over England. Probably the first live performance Charles saw was a pantomime. It was likely a performance by the great clown, Grimaldi. What a great fucking name, Grimaldi the Clown. But that happened when he was about 8 years old. Charles, not the clown, I assume. I assume the clown was probably older than 8 years old. These theaters weren't very good. They were small, dark, and dirty, but they brought the magic theater into his life forever. Charles also participated in school theatricals, in such favorites as the melodrama The Miller and His Men. As he grew up, he developed his talents for acting and mimicry with imitations of, quote, the low population of the streets of London in all their varieties, and, quote, the popular singers, whether comic or patriotic. He could give us Shakespeare by the 10 minutes and imitate all the leading actors of that time, unquote. Charles would have a love of theater and, more importantly, performing in theater that would carry on until the day he died. All the while, he was constantly reading and rereading the books in his father's little library. The 18th century essayists, Robinson Crusoe, The Vicar of Wakefield, Don Quixote, and the works of Fielding and Smollett, S-M-O-L-L-E-T-T, Smollett. And other novels and stories, most notably The Arabian Nights, Arabium, do you hear me with a fucking M? My God. The Arabian Nights and the Tales of the Genii. Jenny, Genii, G-E-N-I-I. Indeed, these books became fundamental to his imaginative world, as is clearly attested by the innumerable quotations from and allusions to all of them in his writings. In 1822, John Dickens was recalled to London, and his family squeezed itself into a smaller house at 16 Baham Street in the very lower middle class suburb of Camden Town. This was a great shock to the young Dickens, who was now hearing much about his father's increasing financial problems. Fucking A, Johnny John Dickens, what the fuck? At the age of 10, Dickens was forced to leave school, which didn't sit with him well, but poor is fucking poor, young Charles. Around this time, he became fascinated by the great world of London, transferring to it all the dreaminess and all the romance with which he had invested in Chatham, and derived intense pleasure from being taken for walks in the city, especially anywhere near the slum area of Seven Dials, which invariably inspired him with wild visions of prodigies of wickedness, want, and beggary. Man, Chuck, way to talk about poor thieves and, I don't know, fucking Jesus. Then Charles gets a little fucking pissed. Well, as pissed as a lower middle class kid in the worst era in England's history could be, because while money was found to send Fanny, his sister, to the Royal Academy of Music, none was found for him. What the fuck, bad with money, Daddy John Dickens? What the fuck? Charles was left, as he once told his friend and biographer John Forster, to be fucked in life as he was in the moment. Fucked, I say. No, I'm kidding. He said he was left to, quote, brood bitterly on all he had lost in losing Chatham and to yearn to be taught something anywhere. Unquote. He thought his parents had given up on him and his future, particularly as his elder sister had been sent to the prestigious music school. Shit, unfortunately, only got worse for Daddy John Dickens, screwing the family's financial situation as it continued to deteriorate. Plus, a rather desperate attempt of Mommy Elizabeth's to establish a school for young ladies, having utterly fucking failed. That didn't goddamn help. Daddy Poor Money Decisions John Dickens was committed to the Marshalsea Debtors' Prison on February 20th, 1824, 2 days after Charles turned 12. Shit. No worries for Daddy, though. No worries for him. He was soon joined in Debtors' Prison by Elizabeth and all the younger children. God, what a shit time to be alive. A bit on debtors' prisons. What were debtors' prisons? They were institutions in which people who couldn't pay for their debts were incarcerated. For centuries, these jails formed a key part of the British prison system. Charles Dickens didn't go there, though. He went to work in a factory due to his family's financial struggles. Dickens found employment via a family friend at Warren's Blacking Factory at Hungerford Stairs, just off of the Strand. Those are all places in England, in London. You can look them up. I did. Weird. Why am I still talking about it? I don't know. At the factory, he pasted labels on blacking bottles for 6 shillings a week, which converts, by the way, in modern terms, to just about, fuck you, you're poor, and you'll stay that way forever, in today's money. Dickens would describe it in a letter sent to one of his close friends, John Forster, his biographer person later. Dickens described his time at the factory and how he used the name of one of his friends there in a later novel. In the letter, he said, I'm fucked. I'll always be fucked, just as hard as in the future as I am in the moment. Fucked, I say, fucked. Of course he didn't say that. He said this.
The Blacking Warehouse was the last house on the left-hand side of the way, at old Hungerford Stairs. It was a crazy, tumble-down old house, abutting, of course, on the river, and literally overrun with rats. Its wainscoted rooms and its rotten floors and staircase, and the old grey rats swarming down in the cellars, and the sound of their squeaking and scuffling coming up the stairs at all times, and the dirt and decay of the place rise up visibly before me, as if I were there again. The counting house was on the first floor, looking over the coal barges and the river. There was a recess in it in which I was to sit and work. My work was to cover the pots of paste blacking, first with a piece of oil paper and then with a piece of blue paper, to tie them round with a string, and then to clip the paper close and neat all round, until it looked as smart as a pot of ointment from an apothecary's shop. When a certain number of grosses of pots had attained this pitch of perfection, I was to paste on each a printed label, and then go on again with more pots. Two or three other boys were kept at similar duty downstairs on similar wages. One of them came up in a ragged apron and a paper cap on the first Monday morning to show me the trick of using the string and tying the knot. His name was Bob Fagin, and I took the liberty of using his name long afterwards in Oliver Twist.
Thank you, Fake Dickens.
Faux shizzle, El Tizzle.
That was weird. Yikes. Working in a factory at 12-ish, 13-ish? Fucking hell. When I was at that age, I was just figuring out what to do with my pee-pee and ouch pouch, and what they were all about. I can't imagine hitting puberty while putting in overtime in a factory. And it was a long fucking day back then. 14 to 16 hours a day, especially in some Victorian-era hellhole, just makes it worse. Just standing there labeling shit while your body is doing its hormonal change thing. Bottles and labels for hours and days on end. And in the 1800s, dirty, soot-covered assembly line kind of situation? Jesus. With ever more oily skin, you know, zits? Maybe cracking, maybe your voice is cracking while getting so many unscheduled surprise boners. Guys know what I'm talking about. They just happened. No reason for it, but bam! There it was, announcing its readiness for ridicule, trying its damnedest to pique the interest and judgment of anyone in the vicinity. Fucking embarrassing. Plus, all the shoddy labeling work from trying to hide it. Can't even fucking imagine. Meanwhile, production is coming to a standstill all the time while everyone nearby is pointing and laughing. A person in the line is all, "Why's your dick so hard, you freaking weirdo?" "I can't help it. I don't know what's happening. It's just doing it." "You freak! Oi! Everyone! I think the little pervert's turned on by the labels. Gross! Is that what's doing it for you, eh? The label, you label-wanking dickens!" "I'm telling you, I don't know why. It just happened." And then the shop foreman shows up and it's, "Oh my! What the dickens is this, Dickens? Again, Dickens? Again? We talked about this, Dickens. You Dickens. You're going home, you little freaky-dicked monster."
"I'm not a monster. Me pee-pee just has a mind of its own."
And that's where the slang usage of using Dickens as a slang term came from. You're welcome for not only the lesson, but the visuals too. No, that's not where Dickens came from. The Dickens, you say. What the Dickens does he want? That actually comes from Shakespearean times, or earlier, as a stand-in for, ready? The word devil. It has nothing to do with Charles Dickens. So now you're welcome. And sorry for all the visuals. I'm trying to sort out my issue with inserting penis talk into book talk. Seriously. I gotta schedule an appointment with a therapist once I can afford one again. Speaking of which, please consider contributing to the podcast Patreon page so that I might get the help I need for all my penis insertion into book talk issues. Oh, and there are exclusive podcasts, so yeah, that too. On the Patreon. Not the penises. I'm pretty sure you can't get a podcast on those. In those? Penis? Moving on. Now, he was on his own. Charles Dickens was on his own, while the rest of his family roomed in a cozy jail cell with Daddy Dickens. Young Charles Dickens lived in a miserable shithole of a lodging house, working long hours in squalid conditions, supervised by cruel, pee-pee-making-fun-of masters. So, of course, Charles's surprise boner factory experience deeply influenced his writing, witnessing the harsh realities of poverty and the plight of the working class, and... okay, probably not a surprise boner episode in there. But still, it changed his worldview. The factory work did, that is. Dickens later described this period of his life as a formative influence on his social consciousness and his commitment to advocating for social reforms. Yeah! But that surprise hard-on shamed good use, Chuck. I do really need to get into therapy again. Though Dickens lived away from his family for only 4 months, John Dickens left the prison on May 28th, having been through the insolvency court, and as luck would have it, received a legacy from his mother. That's kind of like an inheritance. But his son seems to, Charles seems to have remained. Jesus, I can't speak right now. But his Charles seems to have remained working in the blacking factory for another 9 to 10 months. The traumatic experience shaped the rest of his life. I don't know what I'm doing. I went Sean Connery all of a sudden. He came to believe the money and position in Victorian England meant something. His early encounters with such grave conditions gave Dickens rare and deep insight into life's inequalities and greatly enriched his writing. I don't know why I did that. From the day that he entered Jones's school until the day he died, he told no one. His wife and his friend Forrester being the only exceptions. He told no one about his time in the blacking factory or about his father's imprisonment. His parents seemed likewise to have maintained a total silence on the subject. He was finally taken away from the factory when Johnny Bad at Money Dickens, for some reason, quarreled with the proprietor of the factory, that's probably why he was bad with money. He just told everyone that gave him some to fuck themselves or something. Anyway, speculating. Elizabeth tried to arrange for the boys' return to the factory. moms. And Charles never forgave her for that. John, however, retired from the pay office on health grounds, so he wasn't healthy, and was now receiving an admiralty pension, and said that his son should go back to school. Good for Chuck. Upon enrolling at the Wellington House Academy in London, Charles excelled. His aforementioned love of reading took to new heights. He especially liked adventure stories and magical tales by other English writers such as Shakespeare, Tobias Smollett, that's what I said, the guy earlier, and Oliver Goldsmith, and Henry Fielding. He also excelled at the emerging field of mechanical engineering science, seeming to be a child prodigy. He proffered the earliest known description of a modern computer, even sketching one, that accounted for a rudimentary network, as in an internet that would link them. When presenting his ideas to his professor at the time, he was met with derision, saying in a letter to a friend that, quote, "The professor took one look, scoffed, and said bluntly, 'That's a fanciful and useless idea, Dickens. Like a dentist trying to straighten an Englishman's teeth,'" unquote. Oh, another British dental dig! You didn't even see that one coming, did you?
Good God, Shep, call the police. More of his viable listenership has been murdered.
I'm on it.
Oh, holy shit. No, stop. Can he do that? Can you do that?
Yes. No.
Nah. Yeah.
Moving on. Of course, Dickens didn't conceptualize a computer way back in the 1800s. That's just crazy talk. I just think it's fun to think so. Like he was ahead of the curve and everyone just shut him down, even though, you know, hindsight, he was totally right. But people back then, you know, constantly shitting on him is just funny to me. So he resigned, you know, and then when after they shit on him, he just resigned himself to writing. Just like, I can't do anything else right, I guess. Like, yeah, no, you're right. It's terrible. Don't know what I was thinking. I guess I'll just stick to the writing then, I guess. Don't mind me. If you're new, I'm kind of an idiot. At the time of his enrollment, Dickens began submitting penny-a-line material, whereby writers were paid per line for their work, to the British press, much like the pulp writers we talked about in the Doc Savage episode. You should go listen to that after this one. Just, it's fun. And, you get some private Stoneblood dollar stuff in there. For no reason. All right, and if you don't know what that is, that's the Hitler's Holy Relics episode. Just look at me dropping them all in here for no fucking reason. writers were paid a penny a word for the Pulp Fiction stuff. What Dickens submitted largely took the form of factual information about fires, accidents, and police reports. Dickens took great pride in meeting deadlines and beating other reporters to key facts, and his sharp accuracy was well respected. In March 1827, the Dickens family's finances were again in crisis, and Dickens's schooling once more ended suddenly. His parents could not afford to complete his education, and at 15, Dickens reluctantly left school to begin the tedious routine of a law clerk, earning 15 shillings a week. A small pay raise from the six, but fuck. 15 shillings a week, by the way, is exactly what Bob Cratchit's wages were in A Christmas Carol, written by Charles Dickens. He was law clerking at Ellis and Blackmore's Legal Eagle Injury and Unemployment Compensation, where their jingle was, "We don't earn a penny until you do. Then you owe us that penny or it's off to the fucking poorhouse prison. You hear us? Do you fucking hear us?" I'm kidding. It was called Ellis and Blackmore's and then nothing. That's it. That's all I know. Yeah. During his leisure hours, he greatly extended and deepened his knowledge of London. London's street life and London's popular entertainments, meaning strip clubs and prostitutes. You see, at 15, Charles Dickens was, by Victorian standards, a grizzled old man and damn near middle-aged. He had a mortgage, two ulcers, and a horse and buggy that, quote, weren't going to pay for themselves. So, partook in the city's pay-for-play titties. And who could blame him, right? Puffing away on his pipe next to the dimly lit stages as women danced and took things off, and he'd often drone back then. "Back in my day, we would label bottles in factories, and wouldn't you know it, a boner." Unquote. Or something. Sorry. Didn't. Tangent. I'll continue on with what actually happened, not fantasy. He would check out London, its street life and popular entertainment. That is true. And a fellow clerk, George Lear, later recalled, "I thought I knew something of the town, but after a little talk with Dickens, I found I knew nothing. He knew it all from Bow to Brentford." Dickens taught himself Gurney's system of shorthand in just 18 months during that time. It's a difficult task that he immediately parlayed into a job as a newspaper reporter. In November of 1828, he left the lawyer's office to share a box for freelance reporters in Doctors Commons, rented by Thomas Carlton, a distant family connection. I guess a box is a place in an office, like a cubicle, or possibly like a post office box. Maybe they all shared the same box so people could give them assignments there. I don't know. If anyone knows, let me know. It just says box. By 1828, John Dickens, his father, had launched into a new career as a journalist himself and had established himself as a reporter on his brother-in-law's newly launched paper, The Mirror of Parliament. So, Dickens wanted in on that shit. To give it a shot by jumping in at The Mirror of Parliament. I mean, it was founded by his fucking uncle, so getting that gig was probably pretty easy, I think. He gained a great reputation for accuracy, quickness, and sharp observation. He covered the reform bill debates, legislation that extended voting rights to the previously disenfranchised, an experience which both cemented his commitment to reform while at the same time instilled in him a lifelong suspicion of reformers. The paper didn't pay, though, when Parliament was out of session, so Chucky Dickens took to freelancing as a reporter for the newspapers The True Sun, The Mirror of Parliament, as mentioned before, and The Morning Chronicle, where he eventually landed a spot on the staff there. It was around this time that Charles also started publishing tales and sketches of street life under the pseudonym Boz in periodicals such as Monthly Magazine, Bell's Weekly Magazine, and again, The Morning Chronicle. In 1832, he was taken on to the regular staff of the evening paper of The True Sun. While that was happening, Charles Dickens's factory embarrassment pointed him in the direction of its true calling, folks. Ass. Sometime during 1829, he first met a diminutive beauty called Maria Bednell. He fell head over heels in love with her. Dickens wrote about their first meeting.
I saw her looking at a gown through a dressmaker's window. I approached her sheepishly, choosing to pose her, but a simple query. "Excuse me, madam," I asked, "what are your thoughts on the future of dressmaking?" "Excuse me, the future?" She puzzled, quite befuddled. "Oh, yes, milady, you see, I postulate that the future of garment production and manufacture lies in more efficient procurement of raw materials for textile production to better cultivate, a never-before-seen mass consumption. Those processes will allow the creation of garment factories to reproduce facsimiles of dresses, much like that one there in the window, but in great abundance. This will in turn both reduce their cost and increase their availability to fine ladies such as yourself. It needn't be limited to dresses, of course. Everyone will be able to afford different outfits of the same high quality. Multiples, even. The implementation of such a scheme is an idea I very recently sketched out. Should you like to see it?" She looked me over, the puzzlement never leaving her face. After a time, she turned back to the window again and said, "No, no, I would not like to see it, good sir. Should you be curious as to the reason for my denial, I would only say that..." That's the absolute dumbest fucking thing I've ever heard in all my life. And I replied, "Yes, of course, I don't know what I was thinking. I should stick to writing. My apologies, madam." That didn't happen, of course. This was a bit. Another absurdist, nonsensical aberration in the narrative that in all likelihood is the result of Elton's steady and unfortunate diet of stand-up comedy, Monty Python and raunchy, age-inappropriate comedies as a child. Forgive him, for he should know better, but, I imagine, is beyond help at this point.
"Thank you, fake Dickens."
"Glad I could be of assistance."
"Oh, Mr. Dickens, I wouldn't. You'll only encourage him."
"Stay out of this."
"Whoa, did you see that? No? I could swear you would have seen it. Ah, well, too bad. It's time for an ad."
His passion for Maria was to dominate his emotional life for the next 4 years, causing him a fuck ton of torment. Not so much because of the objections that Maria's prosperous banker father no doubt had about entertaining a struggling young freelance reporter with the last name that's a nice way of evoking Satan in polite conversation, especially entertaining him as a prospective son-in-law, but it was because of Maria herself. It seems she seems to have been had a flirtatious disposition, so that Dickens could never be sure of her real feelings toward him. She sometimes treated him with indifference, and sometimes she seemed to encourage his affections. The old hot and cold. Some people can be manipulative shits. If you're in a relationship and you're having this done to you, get the fuck out. It doesn't get better. Believe me. Cut ties and run. You deserve better than that shit. Let that manipulative motherfucker dwindle in your rearview mirror. Later in life, Maria claimed that she truly cared for him. Classic manipulative dickhead. His steely ambition to mark the world in one way or another was given a keener edge by his passionate desire to make her his wife. He sought to improve himself by reading in the British Museum. He read the Shakespeare and the classics, English and Roman history, and he applied for a reader's ticket, which is like a library card at the he applied for that at the first possible moment, just after his 18th birthday. He even thought that becoming an actor would goose his chances with her, going so far as to set up an audition, but he missed the appointment. In early 1833, when Charles turned 21, he threw himself a coming-of-age party, which is something I thought you did when you were like 15 or 16 or something, but whatever. Charles, you do you, man. I mean, regardless, the Bednells were invited and accepted the invitation. During the evening, Dickens spoke privately to Maria. He spoke of his feelings for her, and she insulted him badly by referring to him as a boy. Ouch! Their relationship ended later that year. Maria Bednell went on to become Mrs. Henry Winter. echoes of this relationship with Maria would find its way into many of his later novels, like inspiring the character of Dora in David Copperfield, the character of Flora Finching in Little Dorrit, and the relationship between the characters Pip and Estella in Great Expectations. Charles and Maria would meet up later in life when they were both married, but decided to catch up. Apparently, Chuck didn't like the way the years treated Maria, or maybe she was just as assholish, because despite her wanting to meet up again after that, he cut her off more or less. Ouch for Maria, but also good. Back to Mr. Dickens's Wild Ride. Back to the Boz stuff. He published his first work, Sketches of Boz, in 1836. English professor James Diedrich notes of these efforts, many of the sketches are in fact essays, possessing a colloquial immediacy that vividly captures the lower and middle class street life he observed firsthand, unquote. I don't know if I said quote earlier. I fucking hate when that happens. Anyway, they were intensely popular, these essays, and were ultimately collected in two books, Sketches by Boz and Sketches by Boz II, as well as being turned into a musical stage play called Boz to Men, in which a group of guys in a Philadelphia high school form an a cappella group that became an R&B sensation 100 years in the future. Of course that didn't happen. Of course it didn't happen. I saw Boz too and couldn't resist. These Boz sketches provide much of the subject matter that would later appear in Dickens's fiction. They also set Dickens's reputation as a flaneur, the French-derived literary term for connoisseur of street life. Book publishers Edward Chapman and William Hall were so impressed with the Sketches by Boz that in 1836 they asked Dickens to write a series of stories to accompany illustrations by Robert Seymour, one of England's most popular comic artists. Their plan was for Dickens to write 20 monthly installments, which they would sell for 1 shilling each. Dickens's friends warned that such a publication mode might cheapen his reputation, but up until then, serials were largely for inexpensive reprints of classics or trivial nonfiction. Dickens found just the opposite of these predictions. The following year, his first novel, The Pickwick Papers, was published in serial form, catapulting him to literary fame. Literary fame. Throughout his prolific career, Dickens wrote numerous novels that have become literary classics. Some of his most renowned works include Oliver Twist, Nicholas Nickleby, A Christmas Carol, David Copperfield, Bleak House, and A Tale of Two Cities. His novels often depicted the social injustices of Victorian England, shedding light on the plight of the poor and the child labor. The plight of the poor, child labor, and the brutal conditions of the industrial era. Beyond his writing, though, Dickens was a passionate social reformer. He was deeply committed to improving the lives of the disadvantaged and campaigned for various causes, including education reform and workers' rights. He used his platform and influence to shed light on societal issues, advocating for social change through his writing and public speeches. Dickens's personal life was marked by both success and challenges. He married Catherine Hogarth in 1836, and they had 10 children together. Fucking 10. However, their marriage eventually deteriorated. And they separated in 1858. The breakdown of this marriage deeply affected Dickens, and it had a profound impact on his later works. As it should have, because it turns out, Chucky Dickens was kind of a full-on dick. The Dickens, I'll explain. Now, you know what? Fuck that. I'm calling an audible here. I think you should hear about the Charles Dickens assholeish, about Charles Dickens and what he did from a lady. So, if you wouldn't mind.
What? Why? This is the Elton Reads a Book a Week podcast. That's you, buddy. Why are you trying to drag me in to run your Fleabag circus?
Fleabag? What? Anyway, I thought it would be interesting to hear about this salacious bit of Dickens's life and about what he did to his wife from a woman.
Okay, but seriously, why?
To fucking shake things up in, I don't know, ye old flea bag circus. I guess, I don't think that's a thing.
You actually have to pee, don't you?
Yes, but
I knew it. I knew it. I knew it.
Hey, I might have to shit too. You don't know everything.
God, fine. Someone has to be the adult around this rudderless tugboat.
You have some very weird figures of speech. You know that?
Aren't you going to piss yourself, Captain Weak Bladder?
Oh, yeah, you're right. I'll be fast, I swear.
Okay, so I guess I just pick it up here. Hello, hey, he's gone, so. Hello? Hey, is this? I'll just start here, okay? Right, okay. Charles Dickens was, according to historians, kind of a dick face. Oh, that doesn't sound right. Okay, by his own account, Dickens's marriage was a dismal failure. Having married Catherine Hogarth when he was 24 and she was 22, not a bad age gap. They were engaged for a year before they were married, but it appears that things were kind of rocky from the start. Dickens was infatuated with Catherine's younger teenage sister, Mary. Oh, come on now, Mr. Dickens. Yikes. Not cool. Kind of gross, actually. Hold on. Mary lived with the couple when they were first married. She later died unexpectedly in Dickens's arms. Oh, that's sad. And he was inconsolable. Well, yeah, dead in his arms. Probably traumatized, too. For the rest of his life, he would idealize Mary. What? Okay, not good, sir. Not good at all. He would even use her as a template for many of his virtuous female characters, such as Little Nell in the old curiosity shop. What is going on there? He had the hots for his wife's kid sister? That's no bueno, mi amigos. Listen, folks, if you're ever in a relationship and the other half is like, oh, I love you, you're the best, I don't know what I'd do without you. And by the way, just, you know, kind of throwing this out there, your teenage sister, she's kind of hot. What's her deal? Is she single or, you know, what's happening there? That's the time to recognize a red flag and scoot the hell on out of there. Oh, but wait, there's more. Charles Dickens tried to get his wife into a mental asylum after their separation. Seriously. He tried to have his wife thrown into a mental hospital so he could live with his 18-year-old mistress. Not kidding. See, back in the good old days of Victorian society, divorce was frowned upon. So when it did happen, the process favored men, which meant it was easier for a man to be granted a divorce if his wife had cheated on him than for a woman to secure a divorce if her husband had cheated on her. Since Catherine hadn't done that, Charles had to do something else to get out of his marriage. That's where the asylum comes into play. With that in mind, Dickens released a statement at the time to address the separation. He belittled his wife in writing, saying,
I will remark of my wife that some peculiarity of her character has thrown all the children on someone else.
Thank you, fake Charles Dickens.
Anytime, my good lady.
Dickens, the real one, even tried to bend the law to get his wife and the mother of his children into a lunatic asylum, despite her evident sanity. WTF Charles Dickens. Just wow. And not only that, but he attempted to have his wife incarcerated, too. Why? Booty. Duh. In 1858, the 45-year-old Dickens met 18-year-old Ellen Ternan, an actress. Wait, let me say that again. 45-year-old Charles Dickens met 18-year-old Ellen Ternan. Yuck, yuck, yucky, yuck. He fell in love with her. Uh-huh, I'm sure he did. And in spite of Victorian conventions, made the decision to separate from his wife. Were there other reasons at play here? Well, it just so happens that Charles kind of fell out of love with his wife's looks. For real, after giving birth to 10 children, his 10 children, need I remind you, Catherine was now dowdy and plump, as some mothers tend to freaking get after having 10 freaking children. Come on! Seriously, guys. Her physical charms having faded. Oh, you've got to be kidding me. Dickens now found himself confronted by the fact that he and his wife had nothing in common. They had children in common. Hello? Unintellectual and unimaginative, though by all accounts a warm and loving person, Catherine began to repulse Dickens. Double-double. Wow, wow. Despite it being his doing, as I said before, divorces and separations favored men, which gave Catherine no claim to Dickens' assets or income. That's unbelievable after 10 kids. Ridiculous. Charles offered to provide fairly generously for her financially, though the custody arrangement for the children seems quite harsh. Oh, and whoa, is it? Their son Charlie went to live with his mother while Dickens kept all of the other children, to be raised at Dickens' estate by Catherine's surviving sister Georgina. Most of the children would not speak to their mother again until after their father's death. How's about that, folks? Just toss out the old devoted wife of 20 years and mother of your children for a young 18-year-old actress. Oh, and keep the kids from their mother until you die. And then, the kicker, having your freaking sister-in-law raise them. At the time, there were rumors circulating that his separation from his wife of 20 years was because of the young actress or having intimate relations with his ex-sister-in-law slash current sister-in-law, Georgina. Yuck. It's well known that Dickens did, in fact, have an amatory relationship with at least Ellen, that's for sure, though it's not clear to what extent they were involved before his separation from his wife. Still, it was considered adultery anyway, because he and his wife were still technically married. You have to think that if he was lying to his wife about the nature of his relationship with Ellen, that maybe it's possible that there was some truth to his alleged improper relationship with Georgina. Oh my God, Charles Dickens was a creep.
It would appear that he was indeed.
You're just getting back now?
I got a drink, okay? And maybe a brownie.
Oh, whatever. Here, finish it. I'm done. I feel dirty now.
That's right. Run back to the ether web, inner cyber mesh, wherever you go. Now you know how it feels. I feel dirty all the time. Back to the Dickensian Dickens. In addition to his literary achievements of being a mean creep to his wife's siblings and loved ones, and dating with a huge age gap, Dickens was also a performer, as mentioned earlier. He embarked on reading tours where he entertained audiences with his dramatic readings of his own works, captivating listeners with his vivid character portrayals and expressive delivery. How's that for a turn? Jumping back a little bit, by the way, to when he was still married in 1842, on Valentine's Day, New York held a magnificent event, a ball dedicated to the renowned English author Charles Dickens. Despite being only 30 years old, Dickens had already gained worldwide fame with his literary works, including Oliver Twist and the Pickwick Papers. The elite of New York society reserved the Grand Park Theater as the venue for the ball, adorning it with wreaths and paintings that paid homage to the esteemed visitor. Notably, a bust of Dickens hung from one of the theater balconies with an eagle seemingly soaring above his head. How strange. Throughout the night, Dickens and his wife Catherine danced in the company of approximately 3,000 guests. During dinner the following evening, the novelist expressed his sentiment, saying, "If I could live to grow old," the novelist told a dinner the following night, "the scenes of this and other evenings will shine as brightly to my dull eyes 50 years hence as now." However, what initially began as a promising visit soon devolved into a bitter dispute, famously known as the Quarrel with America. As an ardent advocate for social change, Dickens embarked on his journey with the intent of assessing whether American democracy offered a marked improvement over the class-based society of Victorian England. The author was particularly enthralled by Boston, his initial destination. His hosts were astounded as they observed him traversing the snow-covered streets with unbridled joy, audibly reading the signs adorning the various shops. However, the overwhelming adoration of his American supporters began to weigh heavily on him over time. When Dickens's boat made a stopover in Cleveland, he awoke to find a party of gentlemen staring through the cabin window as his wife lay in bed. If I turn into a street, I am followed by a multitude," Dickens complained in a letter. In a letter? Sounded drunk, didn't I? Dickens complained in a letter. "I can't drink a glass of water without having 100 people looking down my throat when I open my mouth to swallow." Ah, the high price of fame, Charles Dickens. The fame-seeking Americans who attempted to profit from the novelist's renown greatly annoyed him. While in New York, Tiffany's the jewelers created replicas of a bust of Dickens, and an ambitious barber allegedly attempted to sell locks of the writer's hair. Moreover, Dickens was compelled to endure the American dining etiquette of those he shared meals with during his travels across the country. In his book recounting his time in America, titled American Notes, Dickens portrays Midwesterners at dinner as, quote, so many fellow animals, wow, who, quote, strip social sacraments of everything but the mere satisfaction of natural cravings, unquote. According to Professor Jerome Mechier, the author of Dickens, An Innocent Abroad, quote, the longer Dickens rubbed shoulders with Americans, the more he realized that the Americans were simply not English enough, unquote, says Professor, Mechier. He increasingly found them domineering, boastful, coarse, impolite, insensitive, and most significantly, driven by a relentless pursuit of wealth. Huh! Even back then. Dickens had, not all of that, but driven by the relentless pursuit of wealth. America. Dickens had planned an entire week in Washington to determine if American politics lived up to his lofty expectations. His, may I throw this in here, his great expectations. Fucking stupid. Sorry. While there in Washington, he explored the Capitol, engaged with American politicians, and attended President John Tyler's morning reception at the White House. However, Dickens's experience left him in a state of extreme displeasure, with his enduring memory of the city being the widespread habit of spitting tobacco in the streets. In his book, American Notes, Dickens expressed his frustration, stating, quote, Washington may be called the headquarters of tobacco-tinctured saliva. Dickens continued to fume in American Notes, the thing itself is an exaggeration of nastiness, which cannot be outdone. Washington, Dickens chuffed, was the home of, quote, despicable trickery at elections, underhanded tamperings with public officers, and cowardly attacks upon opponents, with scurrilous newspapers for shields and hired pens for daggers. That's some good fucking writing, Charles Dickens. Anyway, regarding the politicians, Dickens concluded that much like the rest of America, the American population, their motivations were driven by monetary gain rather than noble ideals. Expressing his disappointment in a famous letter, Dickens wrote, I am let down. This is not the republic that I envisioned. I had envisioned. Fuck, let me do that again. Dickens wrote, quote, I am let down. This is not the republic that I had envisioned, unquote. At this point of the journey, Americans were equally frustrated with Dickens as the author was with them. The problem at hand was a new one, the matter of intellectual property. A quick definition of intellectual property, okay, from the much, much smarter than me people at Stanford. Intellectual property is generally characterized as non-physical property that is the product of original thought. Typically, rights do not surround the abstract non-physical entity. Rather, intellectual property rights surround the control of physical manifestations or expressions of ideas. Intellectual property law protects a content creator's interest in their ideas by assigning and enforcing legal rights to produce and control physical instant... Oh my god, this fucking word! Instantiations of those ideas. During the year 1842, there were no existing international copyright laws that protected Dickens's work or intellectual property, allowing Americans to freely access pirated editions of his writings. Upon witnessing his immense popularity in the U.S., Dickens came to the realization that he could potentially increase his income twofold if his American admirers began to pay a fair price for his literary creations. Quote, I am the greatest loser alive by the present law, unquote, he complained in letters that he wrote home. Dickens broached the subject delicately with his American audiences, emphasizing the potential benefits of a copyright law for both American writers and himself. During literary dinners, he presented his argument, highlighting the mutual advantages that such legislation could offer. He stressed that he would, quote, he would rather have the affectionate regard of my fellowmen, yes, that is a word, that he wrote, rather than have the affectionate regard of my fellow men, as I would have heaps of as I would have heaps and mines of gold. Unquote. But the American press turned on Dickens, accusing him of mixing pleasure and business. Quote, "We are mortified and grieved that he should have been guilty of such great indelicacy and impropriety," unquote, said the New York Courier and Inquirer, when the country's most popular paper. Quote, "The entire press of the Union was predisposed to be his eulogist, but he urged those assembled, not just to do honor to his genius, but to look after his purse also," unquote. Dickens's visit to America ended with both sides accusing each other of being vulgar money grabbers. I get it. After his arrival back in England, Dickens released two publications detailing his journey to America. Alongside the critical travel account titled American Notes, he also portrayed the country in a scathing manner within a section of his subsequent significant novel, Martin Chuzzlewit. The American press perceived these books as defamatory towards their nation. Quote, "We are all described as a filthy, gormandizing race," raged an article in the Courier and Inquirer, which was edited by James Watson Webb. It described Dickens as a, quote, "low-bred scullion, who, for more than half his life, has lived in the stews of London," unquote. Gormandizing, by the way, or gormandize, is a word I've never heard before this. So if you're in the same place I was,
it means to eat too much. So what he's saying is that Dickens called Americans overeating gluttons with all the trappings that entails.
Thank you again, fake Dickens.
You're very welcome indeed, sir. And if it wouldn't be too much trouble, I'd rather faux, sir. Faux Dickens.
Sure, okay. Dickens faced the disapproval of his American acquaintances, including the renowned writer Washington Irving, who found it difficult to forgive him for mocking their nation in his written works. Quote, "Americans felt they'd welcome Dickens into their country as a hero," says Professor Mechier, "and now there was a sense that he was a traitor." For Dickens scholars, the quarrel with America marks a significant shift in his work. Dickens had a traumatizing experience in America, Professor Mechier says. He became less radical, less optimistic, and he downgraded his view of human nature. Wow. Dickens portrayed his more pessimistic outlook on life in his later novels, including David Copperfield and Bleak House. Despite the disagreement, these books achieved comparable sales to his earlier works. Ultimately, it was his enduring popularity with American readers that resolved the conflict. In his final years, Dickens started conducting immensely popular public readings from works like A Christmas Carol. To gauge the response of American audiences, he dispatched an emissary to assess his reputation. It's so weird. And upon receiving positive feedback, he traveled back to the U.S. in 1867 and 68. Dickens had no reason to be concerned about his reception. To say that his audience followed him with delight hardly expresses the interest with which they hung upon his every word, wrote the Boston Journal. It was not Dickens, but the creation of his genius that seemed to live and talk before the spectators. Almost all of Dickens's American critics were won over by his performances, and the quarrel was declared to be over. Dickens's second coming was needed to disperse every cloud and every doubt, said the New York Tribune, and to place his name undimmed in the silver sunshine of American admiration. Most of that came from a site called BBC.com. Apparently, they're pretty authoritative entity in media circles. So yeah, check them out. They put out a lot of stuff about Great Britain for some reason. I'm kidding. Thank you, BBC, for the information. Though I'm 1,000% sure that you'll never hear this praise. I hope to pay a licensing fee for you one day as a person living in England, should I ever successfully convince my wife to move there with me. Maybe after this podcast piggybacks on a sudden surprise resurgence of returning, you know, to reading physical media, wherein I can finally leave my shit job and do this full time, so I can convince the British government that I already have a job that's mobile, you know, and won't be encroaching on their underpaid, underappreciated workforce. Speaking of which, join my Patreon. There are extras there, a couple more podcasts and outtakes, like the idea to do a bit, actually, about Charles Dickens becoming a gangster rapper 100-plus years before actual gangster rap ever happened. It's bizarre. The link is in the episode description. Sales pitch over. Moving on. Charles Dickens cranked out a lot of very successful novels and other pieces, and was a very successful stage performer and spoken word performer for years, building a worldwide fan base. It was amid that fame that he worked on his latest novel, The Mystery of Edwin Drood. For most of the day on June 8th, 1870, typically Dickens devoted his time to writing in the morning, but on this particular day he had lunch with his close friend John Forster, who would be his biographer later. He had lunch with him before returning to his novel in the afternoon. At 6:10 p.m., just after reuniting with his family for dinner, Dickens suffered a stroke. 24 hours later, the renowned author of Victorian England passed, leaving behind a remarkable literary legacy. His works continue to be celebrated for their vivid characters, social commentary, and compelling narratives, making him one of the most influential and enduring writers of the English language. Dickens's contribution to literature and his commitment to social justice continue to resonate with readers around the world, ensuring his place in the pantheon of literary greats. One of those contributions is what we'll be hitting on right fucking now. Greatly Great Expectations. Great Expectations. Or known to people like myself who don't stupidly change the title for no reason. Just Great Expectations. The setting and events in the book mirror a lot of what happened in Charles's own life, which, apart from David Copperfield, is his most autobiographical novel. Pip, the novel's protagonist, lives in the marsh country, for instance, as a young boy. In the opening scene of the book, Dickens describes the marshes as a dark, flat wilderness intersected with dikes and mounds and gates with scattered cattle feeding on it, and describes the River Thames as a thin line on the horizon. Dickens used to take long walks with his father through the area and would continue to do so, often walking there when he returned as a successful author to live in nearby Higham. Pip, the story's protagonist, also works at a job he fucking hates, much the same as Dickens did in that fucking factory. Only Pip was a blacksmith's apprentice, and Charles, you know, was an awkward preteen, allegedly getting random boners on the factory floor. Allegedly. You can't prove he didn't. Pip also considers himself too good for his surroundings and experiences material successes in London at a very early age, exactly as Dickens himself did. In addition, one of the novel's most appealing characters, Wemmick, is a law clerk, and the law, justice, and the courts are all important components of the story, all of which Charles Dickens was familiar with due to his work history. So what's it all about? What's so great about Great Expectations? Does Great Expectations live up to the, well, Great Expectations? They don't. Thanks for listening, everybody. You have a good night. If you enjoyed this episode of, I'm kidding. Stupid. Great Expectations is a novel by Charles Dickens. The novel was first published as a serial in Dickens's weekly periodical all the year round, from December 1st, 1860 to August 1861. In October of 1861, Chapman and Hall published the novel in three volumes, Dickens' 13th novel. It is set in the early 19th century in early 19th century England and tells the story of the orphan Pip, who is raised by a blacksmith and his sister, but later comes into great expectations of wealth due to a mysterious benefactor. The novel was very popular when it was first published, and it remains one of Dickens' most popular works today. Pip, an orphan residing with his abusive sister and her husband, Joe Gargery, the village blacksmith. Pip's sister, when first encountered in the novel, is a straight-up asshole, while Joe is a simple...
Pardon me.
Fake Dickens. What's going on?
Actually, sir, I'd much prefer faux Dickens to fake, if you don't mind. I feel it lends an air of regal flair and distinction that I find missing from traditional English.
Sure. I don't understand. How can I help, I guess?
Thank you kindly, sir, for talking with me. I'm so sorry for interrupting. I was only wondering if I might be of further assistance in any capacity toward the completion of this particular episode, possibly. You see, sir, I've only really been put to service rather sparingly, you see. A few lines here and there. Not that I'm ungrateful, mind you. Absolutely not. No, sir, I'm truly in your debt. I was only wondering if maybe you could find your way to including me, perhaps in any additional work in the execution of this material, sir. I honestly don't want to impose, and if I'm out of line, please by all means tell me. I would relish the opportunity to contribute more to this episode.
You want to do what? You want to be included more, maybe? Is that it?
If you think it wouldn't be too much of a bother, sir.
No. Yeah, no, sure, go ahead, I guess.
Oh, thank you indeed, sir.
Sure. You're welcome. Sure. Have at it. Have at it.
I am ever so grateful. Joe Gargery is a significant character in Great Expectations. As the protagonist Pip's quasi-surrogate father, he's a positive role model for the boy, helping him to grow and mature. While a simple man, Joe has a good heart. Is a loyal friend who is always willing to help others, a hard-working, loving husband and father, demonstrating many times that he is always there for his family. A skilled blacksmith by trade, Joe takes great pride in his work, beginning the novel teaching Pip the craft. It's assumed Pip will take on blacksmithing later. He is, however, naive and easily manipulated. Joe is a good man, yes, but also capable of making mistakes. Joe is a well-developed character who is both relatable and memorable. He is symbolic of hope and redemption, representing the possibility of overcoming adversity and achieving success.
Beautiful, beautiful faux Dickens.
If I may, sir.
If you may, what?
The family lives on the Kent marshes. While exploring the churchyard where his parents are buried, Pip is confronted by an escaped prisoner. The prisoner frightens Pip into stealing food and a metal file from Joe's forge to remove his leg iron. The following morning, Pip returns with the stolen items, only to discover another escaped convict, who is the first one's foe. Shortly after, both convicts are apprehended while fighting each other. Pip's arrogant uncle, Pumblechook...
He's an asshole, too.
Yes, he is an ass.
Faux Dickens. Whole.
Yes, certainly, sir. Uncle Pumblechook arranges for Pip to visit the home of a wealthy recluse named Miss Havisham, a strange woman who has been living in a state of mourning ever since her fiancé left her at the altar on their wedding day, who lives in her dilapidated house with a young girl she's adopted, named Estella, whom she is raising to be a cold and heartless woman. Pip is invited there to play with her.
Pumblechook, Havisham, Estella, all assholes.
One can suppose.
They are, faux Dickens. Hey, what are you doing anyway?
The house is a peculiar nightmare realm. Miss Havisham was abandoned by her fiancé on their wedding day and still dons her wedding gown, despite her old age and confinement to a wheelchair. The house remains untouched, with even the wedding cake preserved on the table. Estella, though beautiful, exhibits arrogance and informs Pip that he is rough and ordinary. Despite the mistreatment from Estella and Miss Havisham, Pip finds himself drawn to Estella. Despite the emotionally distressing and degrading visits, Pip continues going for several months to spend time with Estella and assist Miss Havisham. He also encounters Miss Havisham's deceitful relatives, who covet her wealth and despise Pip. Pip manages to earn a kiss from Estella when he defeats one of the relatives, known as the Pale Young Gentleman, in a physical altercation. In his pursuit to win Estella's admiration, Pip endeavours to improve himself by working harder at night school with his friend Biddy, whose grandmother runs the school. After several months, Miss Havisham covers the cost of Pip's apprenticeship in blacksmithing under Joe. Pip had eagerly anticipated this opportunity for years, but now that he has glimpsed the sophisticated lifestyle, he perceives his work at the forge as a death sentence. Nevertheless, he conceals his sentiments from Joe and dutifully fulfills his responsibilities. During this period, he encounters a peculiar individual at the Jolly Bargeman, a nearby tavern. This man possesses the file that Pip had stolen for the convict years ago. In an unexpected turn, the man presents Pip with 2 1-pound notes. Pip continues his tradition of visiting Miss Havisham on his birthday, and on one such occasion his early departure from work triggers a physical altercation between Joe and Joe's assistant, Dolga Orlik.
He's another asshole. This whole book, rife with assholes. Hey, foe, when do you think I can jump back in with...
Orlik harbors resentment towards Pip, and despises Pip's abusive sister. On his way home from the visit, Pip learns that his sister narrowly escaped murder, but has been left mentally disabled. Biddy moves in with them to offer assistance. Despite Biddy's lack of education and refinement compared to Estella, Pip finds himself attracted to her. One evening, a prominent lawyer from London named Mr. Jaggers pays a visit to Pip and Joe, revealing that Pip has great expectations. Overwhelmed with joy, Pip assumes that Miss Havisham is the source of his unexpected fortune, as she intends to groom him for Estella. He acquires a new set of clothes and is astonished by the contrasting treatment he receives from Mr. Trabb, the tailor, and Uncle Pumblechook. When Pip reprimands one of Trabb's shopboys for not exhibiting the appropriate respect towards him, he realizes how wealth alters people's behavior. He engages in a conversation with Biddy, urging her to assist in improving Joe. However, when she suggests that Joe does not require any improvement, Pip accuses her of being envious of him. By the end of the week, Pip embarks on his journey to London, where he aspires to become a gentleman.
All right, Faux Dickens, damn it. That's a good place to stop. Stop.
I'm so sorry, sir. I just couldn't help myself. It'll never happen again, I assure you.
Like what the shit was that? You just took the hell over and ran away with the fucking thing.
I know, sir, I do. I take full responsibility for the hijacking of this episode. I honestly do humbly and thoroughly apologize profusely, sir. Forgive me.
It's cool, Faux. You just can't give away the whole story, man. Besides, that's a good place to leave it. As what happens after that point is just a bunch of crazy twists and surprises, like finding out who Pip's benefactor is and who Estella's parents really are, sort of. And does Pip get with Estella? I mean, read it. It's a great story. It really is. You find out what happens with Joe and Biddy and the whole slate of characters that are in it. Miss Havisham, all of that. And Pip, does he end up fucking rich? Or what, right? What happens to Pip?
I could just tell them, sir. It really would be no trouble at all.
No, damn it. People should read more, and this is a great story for them to read. Read it, folks. Listen, read it. You won't be disappointed. Plus, it's a public domain book, so it's free. Fucking shit. I should have told you to buy the Amazon-affiliated link version of the book. I get a little kickback from Amazon if you do. I shouldn't have told you it was free. I should have sold you on it, you know, before telling you the novel is free online anywhere. And audiobook on Spotify, and you can download it anywhere. I'm a bad salesperson for myself. Terrible with promotions, in addition to being just awful with social media. Yeah. Plus, you know, I wouldn't want to sell you on a fucking real book without telling you can get it for free. That's terrible. Great Expectations is seriously a great book. It is very accessible. Really, it's not written all old Englishy and like Shakespeare. Like, holy fuck, you have to look up half the words in that fucking shit to make it make sense. Great Expectations isn't like that. It's very accessible. And it's regarded as one of Dickens's
greatest novel and continues to be studied and analyzed and celebrated for its literary merit, as memorable characters and really, really, really vivid descriptions. Good descriptions. It's very well written. And it's got an engaging plot. It's made it a staple of English literature for fucking ever. The novel's enduring popularity has ensured its place in the literary canon, and its ongoing influence in its influenced subsequent generations of writers. It had a profound historical impact upon its own time and in the years that followed. It was and is still renowned for its social critique and the realistic portrayal of Victorian society, which is kind of shitty. The novel highlights the stark class division, social injustice, and influence of money and status on personal relationships. Dickens's vivid depiction of characters from various social strata shed light on the harsh realities of the time, raising awareness and sparking discussions about social issues. And here's a freaky fun fact about it. The character of Miss Havisham, the eccentric recluse in the story, who was trapped in time. She can't move on. It inspired a curious trend during the Victorian era. Her eerie presence in the book sparked a fashion fad, for wearing a wedding dress long after the wedding day has passed. Perhaps her haunting existence held a peculiar allure that captivated the imaginations of those seeking a touch of the unconventional. Or people were kind of given permission that they needed to justify wearing their expensive-ass one-time-only dress more than once. Because fucking A, wedding dresses are expensive. I don't know how much they were back then, but I can only assume. Another fun fact, Great Expectations has two endings referred to as two. One is referred to as the original ending, and the revised ending. Most publications, get this, have the revised ending, since it's the one that was originally published. But discussions about the original ending and its implications for the narrative continue to occur in academic circles, because fighting over the ending of a novel written over 160 years ago is better than hammering out world hunger and peace and poverty, I guess. The original ending was taken as being a little bit sad. Wilkie Collins, a close friend and author of The Woman in White, objected to the not-so-happy ending Dickens first wrote for Great Expectations. So, Dickens, being the people-pleaser he is, rewrote it to resolve in a happier way. Writing to friends about the revised ending, Dickens seemed positive. "I have put in as pretty a little piece of writing as I could, and I have no doubt the story will be more acceptable through the alteration. And upon the whole, I think it is for the better." George Bernard Shaw said that the novel is too serious a book to be trivially a happy one. Its beginning is unhappy, its middle is unhappy, and the conventional happy ending is an outrage on it. So, there you go. Pick your ending, I guess. You have to read the book, though, to figure out what... Okay. One more fun fact. Charles Dickens lived about 15 minutes away from Karl Marx. You know, the guy that wrote the Communist Manifesto. Seriously, I'm not kidding. There's no proof that they ever got together, but also there's no proof they didn't get together either. What if, in some random London coffee shop, Karl Marx and Charles Dickens happened to stop in at the same time? Maybe the place is crowded and they pick the same cafe table, you know, by a window facing the street. Would they have talked about social injustices, the political turmoil of the times affecting the downtrodden masses, maybe? Some socio-philosophical ruminations about freeing the proletariat from the shackles of the bourgeoisie? Or maybe, just hear me out, maybe Carl is sitting there by the window, sipping his tea, looking out at the street life beyond. An older Charles Dickens asks,
"Excuse me, sir, is this seat taken?"
"Oh, no, sir. Please, by all means, join me."
"Thank you kindly, my good man."
They would sip their tea quietly for a while. Maybe Charles interrupts.
"Sir, I couldn't help but notice that, actually, I'm sorry, forgive my intrusion. Apologies, I should introduce myself before adding more insult to my injury. My name is Charles Dickens.
Oh my, the Charles Dickens? Really? My goodness, it's an honour, sir. Truly, I'm beside myself. Oh, I've almost forgot my own name. Karl Marx, sir. Pleased to make your acquaintance, Mr. Dickens.
Thank you, Karl. The pleasure and honour is all mine, really, sir. To the point of my grotesque breach of social etiquette, I couldn't help but notice how deeply in thought and troubled you were, peering out that window there. Such overburdening concern is terrible for the health indeed. I only wanted to offer, perhaps, an ear to bend to alleviate, if only for a moment, whatever ails you. I merely wanted to offer my assistance, and if little else, maybe a pleasant chat, if I could.
Oh, no, no, no. No need to concern yourself, Mr. Dickens. I'd love nothing more than a pleasant chat with you on any topic. I was only pondering on the retarding effect of the bourgeoisie exploitation of child labour on the industrial progression of the state at large and the ramifications thereof.
Oh, actually, this is remarkable. I believe I might contribute some rather compelling, albeit embarrassing, material on that very subject. Though it is purely anecdotal, it may substitute as a first-hand account or testimony, rather. Though, of course, that is to say that you're not easily vexed by a discussion involving pubescent factory workers being chastised just for being assailed and blindsided by their own anatomy in the form of spontaneous, hormonally instigated erections.
By Jove, no. Surprise bonus? Are you kidding? I find the subject both disturbing, troubling, and yet infinitely fascinating. What is the deal with that, right? Where in God's name do they come from? And more importantly, why? Am I right, Mr. Dickens?
Exactly, Carl. Exactly. Especially when they occur in a factory setting. I mean, the social stigma and mockery alone, it's enough to make one vomit. Well, if you'll allow me to let my personal cowardice hold sway for a moment, I'll avoid a trove of unpleasant details, good sir. I can only say that in those overly excited moments, I often wanted to just, I don't know, seize the means of production, you know, to be the one to bring that whole godforsaken factory to a screeching halt. The wretched overseers just expected everything to keep droning on in those horrifying and embarrassing moments. There I am, ruddy-faced and rock-hard, sir, a hostage of my own ghastly anatomy. Then, adding insult to injury to get castigated mercilessly, I can still hear the horrid foreman's raspy-throated ignorance echoing in my memory. "Dickens," he'd say, "control that reckless cock and balls of yours before it goes tipping another bottle to the floor." Or "that Dickens, he just can't control his dick end." Indeed. Then all the other workers laughing rushed in to fill that awkward, humiliating void. So much laughing. Cruel, ruthless bastards, the lot of them.
Now wait, what you said? That's very interesting what you mentioned there. Seizing the means of production. You may be onto something, Mr. Dickens? Yes, yes, we're the proletariat to seize the very means of production. My, they could set their own agenda, couldn't they? Dictate the terms of their place in the societal hierarchy, or even decide an entirely new one, whole cloth, freeing themselves from bourgeois oppression. Yes, that's very interesting indeed, Mr. Dickens. Say, I think you might be onto something, sir. Seizing the means of production, I dare say, might be the very concept to anchor and clarify a point in my developing philosophy on socio-economic restructuring. I've been struggling to put it into words properly for so long. Thank goodness for this chance meeting. Leave it to a brilliant writer to succinctly refine it. Thank you.
Yes, I suppose it could be meaningful in that application. Fine, whatever. Regardless, as I was stating it as a reaction to my being mocked in an overtly cruel way, all for, atrociously, I might add, all for exhibiting normal bodily function for a child my age. An overworked, underpaid child. I had no control over my wee Willy Winky any more than that bastard of a foreman has over the sky. Control your dick end, Dickens. Then the revolting laughter from that collection of loathsome, vulgar half-wits. It still rings in my ears like an open wound on my soul. Control your dick end, Dickens. My dick end, indeed.
Oh, come now, Mr. Dickens. As a man of such palpable talent and intellect, surely your cynosure on adolescent pee-pee problems could now be seen as a trial by which the result made you the success you are today. Besides, good sir, given the gulf of time between then and now, surely you have to admit, Dickens, control your dick end. Now that is just bloody hilarious.
Fuck you, Karl Marx.
Seriously, a dick joke is where you landed on this one?
What? That's a semi-solid callback. What's the problem?
Psh, where do I start? You could have talked about Charles Dickens' writing habits. The guy would start writing at 9 in the morning and worked nonstop till 2. He'd stop for lunch and then take a walk around London for 3 hours. 3 hours! You didn't even think to drop that in.
I ran out of time. 9-hour podcasts are a little ridiculous, don't you think?
You could serialize it like Dickens did with the Pickwick Papers.
Hey, maybe I could serialize like a story, like a novel. Like have a storyline, while also including the other books.
Oh, come on. You think you can write an entire novel? You had to rope Karl Marx in just to make a dick joke work, Elton. And a bad one at that.
She's, not wrong, you know.
Oh, fuck you, Karl Marx. Thank you for listening to Elton Reads a Book a Week. If you enjoyed this episode and want to contribute to the production of the podcast and become one with the podcast, become part of the lifeblood of the podcast, then please consider contributing via Patreon. Link in the description, because I think I advertised the fuck out of it in the episode, didn't I? And if you're not... Sorry, I just thought it was funny how people do that. Anyway, if you're not in a position to do that, you know, money's tight and such, and inflation and shit, you can always help by sharing the podcast with a friend, relative, stranger on the subway, Mariby. What a fucking word is that? Share it with a stranger on the subway or any stranger anywhere, you know, I'm in no way condoning anything like this, but you know, maybe it gets written in a public space, in a bathroom stall, you know, Elton Reads a Book a Week, maybe tagged on a building. Who knows? I have no way of predicting which way your creativity will take you. And by the way, vandalism is a crime if you're caught. You've been warned. Above all else, though, thank you for listening. I appreciate it. I really do. So much. You have no idea. And do yourself a favor, by the way. Start a book this week. I'm not kidding. Start a book. Read a book this week. Don't let them die out. Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
So I'm still in limbo, so to speak, on the being at rest thing. Any word on when that's gonna get handled? Hello? Hello? Anyone? Anyone? Oh, for Pete's sake.